So this is going to be part one of the Q&A with Abel. We're going to have this on my channel, and then part two will be on his channel. So we'll have a link below. Go ahead and check out his channel for part two. And if you guys have other questions you want answered on the next Q&A, go ahead and post below.
All right, everybody. So today, back on the podcast, another Q&A with Abel Chabayi. How are we doing, man?
Hey, I'm good. Finally, book writing is done. So I'm looking forward to making more videos again. No conflict when I sit down to do something. Like, should I be making a video because I shouldn't abandon my channel completely? Or should I be writing on the books? Like, I'm bad at setting priorities for myself like that. So
Sure, now it's clear. So now you're going to see Abel on the podcast game. He's going to be on everybody's podcast promoting his book. He's got, when is it, Joe Rogan? Is it next week or 2 weeks from now?
Yeah, well, I somehow need to create some attention there. But although it's his new studio is very intimidating. That old one I liked a lot more. It was like very friendly looking.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm gonna be like one of those, like, always finding an excuse to mention the book somehow.
Right.
So
Yeah, so I know you sent it to me, and so my brother actually just wrote a novel recently, and I told him I will finish it by 2025 because I will go through audiobooks like crazy, podcasts like crazy, articles. Somebody sends me an article, I'll just read it right away. But books, as I was saying before we started calling, like, I only read books when I'm ready to go to sleep at night as a way to wind down, and it's such a surefire way to get me to sleep. I'll read 2 pages and I'm out. So yeah. I'll finish your ebook probably around 2026, I think.
Yeah, but it's kind of crazy. Like, I'm actually the same way. So, and like, it kind of makes sense that reading is more sleep inducing than watching a video, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
But by how much, I'm always surprised. So if I'm watching a video on YouTube or something in bed, then I can stay away for a very long time. Whereas with reading, yeah, it just like immediately.
It is kind of amazing. Like, I will have numerous times where it's like, let's say it's 10 p.m. and I'm like, well, I should start getting down soon, but I'm completely awake. And then I'll get in bed and I'll sometimes just have the book in my hand and I'm just kind of thinking for a minute and then I'm just out. Like, it's so quick with books for me, which is funny because, like I said, when I read articles like on my laptop, it's no problem. You know, I'll go through them pretty quickly, but something about that, which again, it's nice because a lot of people have a very hard time falling asleep. So to have something that can kind of just take care of it is nice.
Yeah. For me as well. Like, for me to hang out in the living room and, like, I don't know, play PlayStation or something, and then feel like, okay, I cannot keep my eyes open. For that, I need to be incredibly, incredibly tired.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, in bed, it's immediately flips. So kind of just like illustrates the importance of actually having a routine and not just leaving it up to, I mean, for some people it probably is different, but for me, like, it's important to have a routine and not just leave it up to when I feel tired.
Sure. All right. So we've got another batch of questions here for Q&A. So for people who are just tuning in, we do these Q&As probably every month or two, a couple months, I would say. And if you send like a DM, that's a good way to get the questions answered. Sometimes on the YouTube comments, I would say Instagram though is probably the best bet. So we'll start off here. We've got Hung No, which I'm definitely saying his name incorrectly. Let's see. So, hey Dave, I've been listening to a lot of Abel's older podcasts with Jorge Fagerly and listened to your episode with him. What's your thoughts on desensitization phase and not training for 2 weeks? Is there value doing that for an average lifter only interested in hypertrophy? Do muscles actually get detrained so it triggers more stimulus with lighter volume? All right. You want to go first? Because I know you had a lot of work with Jorge and all that.
Yeah, so that was an interesting time. And actually, sometimes I'm contemplating doing some long video on actually talking through how that whole period was with Berge, because it's, you know, like, seriously, not just from a training and like fitness education standpoint, but also from like existential standpoint. But anyways, so yeah, that's one of those things that I had a hard time, I guess, just mentally being on board with, because it's not what I would prefer to do, for sure. Taking 2 weeks off to get some kind of a resensitization benefit. And like, I personally cannot say that I've ever experienced coming back from a layoff and then getting past my previous best surprisingly fast, but from others, I have heard anecdotes like that. So for that reason, like, I think that is one of those things, like rest pause or ultra high frequencies or weighted stretching or like a lot of these things that are interesting ideas. I don't think enough people have vetted it out so that we could like really have any kind of clear idea as to like what we can expect from it. But I don't like, it seems a little bit woo-woo to me. Like, typically you do things and then you do them consistently. If you do too much, then you need to lay off a little bit, like need to reset things a little bit, like let that fatigue dissipate. But typically things just don't work like that in life, that like you hack the system by like pretending like you're stopping with it and then you're new to the stimulus again and then you stimulate again and then this magical thing happens. Usually it's not how it works, but I mean, I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, so I am not a big practitioner of that. I think deloads and the like are fine. That's a little bit different, right? It's like, okay, you know, your body needs a little bit of a break. Maybe it's a mental break that you need. That, in my opinion, is different. But like this desensitization kind of stuff, like the hypertrophy specific training guy, Brian Haycock. Yeah. You know, he talks about this a lot. I just don't think I don't think there's too many examples where just physiologically, where just backing off is then going to result in this increased stimulus that's going to net you further than you would have been. So what I mean by that is it is true that after you, let's say you detrained for a month, right? When you come back, it is true that a smaller stimulus will create a response, but it doesn't matter if it creates a response. You won't eventually have a response that gets you past where you were, right? So like, yeah. You know, anybody will tell you if you took a year off from training, when you come back, you're going to grow like a weed. But is that going to then allow you to get further than you ever were? No, I don't think so. And an example of this would be like, if you were to be like, what would you, if you're trying to get as tan as possible, would you think it's going to be better to be outside every day for a week? Or would it be better to be outside for 2 days, then take, you know, a day off and then 2 days? Like maybe when you come back from a little bit of time off, you'll get a little bit extra burned or tan, but not more than the accumulation would have been over that week. You know, I don't think you'd get past that point. I don't think it's something that's super useful. I know like that's a principle that RP uses with like, you know, their deloads and whatnot in the mesocycles, and the idea being that once you have the time off, then you'll need a less stimulus. I don't see it play out like that. I don't see the guys who are using desensitization. I don't see the guys who are using, you know, these frequent deloads getting further than anybody else. I think it's fine. Like, I don't think it's worse necessarily. I'm not saying these guys are getting worse results. I just don't think it's doing what people claim it does.
Agreed.
Okay, so this was an interesting question by Liam Bonner. I'm a fan of the podcast. I was wondering how many inches of abs/oblique/lower back muscle did you put on your waistline from when you were 18 until your current size? Which I actually think is a great question because, you know, it's very clear that bigger guys generally are not going to have very tiny waistlines. I mean, obviously at the extreme, you look at like the IB Pro, like Jay Cutler, I probably on stage had a 36 plus inch waist, I'm guessing, right? With how big some of these guys' stomachs get. Yeah. But just from more muscle mass. So I don't know if you have records like that, Abel. I can tell you that for me, I had pictures back when I was about 130 pounds and I had about a 29 inch waist and I was not that lean. Like I couldn't see my abs. I was probably 14% body fat or something, but just no muscle at all. And I had a 29 inch waist. Now at that same body fat, which is basically where I'm at now, I'm a little above that now. I'm probably like 16-17% now. So at 14%, I'd say 32, maybe even 32 and a half inch waistline. So I mean, you're talking probably a good 3 inches. But I'm also sitting about 195, right? So 190, 195 of that body fat. So you know, 60 pounds of mass later, probably about 3 inches, I would say.
Yeah. So I'm thinking now, and I think that when I first got lean, like 10%, probably a bit under, looking back, maybe like 9%. At the time, I was like, yeah, like 75 kilos-ish. Mm-hmm. And then I know that if I flexed my abs as hard as I could, then my waist was around like 78 centimeters off and under. And like now, last summer, I was not 9% body fat, but, you know, like close to 10-ish, like mid-low 80s body weight-wise. And then my waist was like, yeah, like 80, 84, 85 centimeters, like thereabouts, fluctuating there, flexed, like air blown out. Yeah. So that's, yeah, how, what is that? It's similar to yours, right? Like that's a bit less than 3 inches, but 2.5 inches.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and just a reminder, people, I mean, waistline is really, I think, a great overall tool to use. I'm big on measurements, but you just got to keep in mind that they're just one tool, right? So arm measurements, they might go up, but did you just gain a ton of body fat? Waistline, just because it did go up, doesn't mean that you necessarily are fatter over a long period of time. Like if you're doing like a 1 year bulk and your waistline's going up, like, yeah, you almost certainly have gained some fat around there. But, you know, we're talking like decade plus and 50 pounds of mass later, then yes, of course, it is going to go up over time. And that's where calipers and whatnot would be very useful.
And probably your shoulders will have gone up as well in that time. So your V-taper ratio is same or better.
Right, right. Yep. All right. So this one is a long one. So I'll read quickly. Cole Henry, actually a former client of mine. Hey, Dave, hope you're doing well. I wanted to ask for some training advice if you don't mind. At this point, I'm almost 4 years into training. Basically shifted from prioritizing aesthetics to strength. Still care about muscles, care about getting stronger more. Been stuck on a few key lifts. Let's see, squat, bench, weighted chins, OHB. Bench is 270 for four. Chins at 200 pounds body weight is 95 times three. Good job, man. Squat is 345 times five and OHP 200 times three. So, you know, just first I'll just say that's quite good for just now four years in. Train every other day, four times a week. I train each of those lifts 1 to 2 times per week. I've seen some of your lifts. You're really strong considering your body weight. So do you think since I've been stuck for a few months here, it's time to switch up the frequency or volume of those lifts? Or at this point in my training, should I only expect improvement after like 3 or 4 months? Was there anything you did in particular, similar point in your strength that helped you push through plateaus? I understand this loaded question. Cool. So I can go first on that one. Pretty involved. So, and actually, again, Cole, this guy is on the shorter end. I don't remember the exact height, but again, 200 pounds body weight to be doing that with the pull-ups and everything is quite good. So first of all, I would just say you are getting to that level of strength where for most people, things are definitely going to slow down. I mean, obviously there are some phenoms who, that's their beginning weight. And then there's some people who never surpass that, but that is definitely a level of strength that things will start to slow down. And I don't think just like the completely basic programming is necessarily going to work. I would say I'm not super big on just initially increasing a ton of volume. I don't know what your weekly volume is for these lifts. I do like increased frequency from a practice standpoint. And I do also like accessory lifts, not to the extent like a West Side Barbell type where they're just doing so many variations and where at some point you're almost not even doing something that's that similar. But I do think some variations can be helpful and then coming back to it. So like if we take a squat, for example, right, very common advice would be to say, all right, try pause squats. So if you're just doing like regular squats there, keep the bar position the same, but go and like hold a pause position. I think Craig Knuckles actually had a period where he said he gained a shocking amount of strength by just doing very long pauses at the bottom to get your explosive strength up. Another option would be a box squat, right? Where it's allowing you to kind of get to a certain depth. Maybe that's even above parallel. That would be focusing on a different sticking point, obviously, than maybe doing a deep pause. So I would say recording yourself on these lifts and seeing where the weakest point is, because a lot of times people think, okay, like let's say you're halfway up on a bench and you think, well, this is my sticking point. Well, just that may be your sticking point, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's exactly where you need to work. You may need to work below that sticking point to increase your strength there to push past the sticking point, right? So I might try out some different ranges of motion. Again, pause work I think is good and see what can push past that point. That with increased frequency is probably where I would start. And then obviously nutritionally, this isn't probably going to help the pull-ups very much, but for the big three for sure, just if you want to add strength, obviously being in a calorie surplus is always helpful there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even really have that much to add to that per se. I was actually going to ask back, like, so this guy's goal was strength specifically, so it's not just like progressing in general to get bigger and then using these lifts as a benchmark.
It sounds like now he's prioritizing the strength specifically.
Okay. So I was going to ask, like, regarding the range of motion and like where your sticking point is, like, so how do you think about that? Because that thought process that, okay, you need to work on certain areas within the lift where you tend to fail, I mean, it could make sense, but then there's the alternative, right? Which is like you're failing the lift there simply because that's where your muscles are, the like just not leveraged well. So it's always going to be your sticking point no matter what you do. So like you can get stronger there, but you have to fail the lift somewhere. So like there's always going to be a sticking point. You cannot just eliminate that. So basically just lift normally and then eventually you will get stronger. So how do you think about that generally?
Yeah, I don't think anybody really has a perfect answer on that. I remember back years ago, Ben Escrow, who was a Lane Norton strength coach for a while. He might still be, I'm not sure. And I remember him saying how he wasn't a fan of band work or anything like that. He was, because it was all about the lift. Like he was all about specificity because he was like, that's the lift. Like that's what we want to focus on. Whereas other people, it's bands, it's chains, it's so many variations. And they only, again, like Westside, they might only do an actual deadlift every couple of months, right? So and regarding like the sticking point, of course you are going to fail at some point. And is that sticking point going to change dramatically? I think most people, just again based on the biomechanics of it, are going to probably fail at a similar place. Like if I think of every squat I've ever failed, it's usually a few inches out of the hole, right? Like I don't think I've ever failed a squat where I'm like 4 inches away from getting it and then I just can't get it, right? It's usually like a pretty similar spot. Which is why, again, I am a fan of the pause work, because I think for most people, you're going to have this point. Let's take OHP, if you're watching this on video, you know, it's like here, if I don't get it, it's like right there, right? And then I guess, and actually OHP specifically, I have had a couple times where I just am like up there and I just can't lock it out. But most of the time, it is same with bench press. Most of the time, if you get it past that halfway point, you're going to get it. That's why I'm a big fan of like the pause work. When I had a powerlifting coach, he had me doing a lot of the paused work, a lot of like triples and singles at that, in that paused area. So, or excuse me, it was a lot of triples and singles at that stretched part of the range of motion. And that was when I had actually increased my deadlift like 100 pounds in a year. It was a very good gaining phase for me. A lot of, in the case of deadlifts, it was a lot of deficit deads. So again, it was getting to that like really end range of motion and kind of increasing explosive power. I don't know if that answers your question. I guess you're specifically saying like, how do you determine it? And I guess I would say I'm leaning more towards the stretched bottom position of these lifts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. All right. Well, yeah, that's about as much I had to add to that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. So we'll go to the Instagram questions here. So what do you guys think of Jordan Peters' approach of training to failure on all sets? Well, Jordan Peters, he's a psychologist, right? Big on the carnivore diet. So for people who don't get the joke. So Jordan Peterson, right? And then there's Jordan Peters. And then there was George Peterson, who was an IFBB pro. So there's a lot of similar names there. Yeah. Yeah. But Jordan Peters is the one who people might know from Scott Stevenson. They're pretty friendly. He was kind of more like following like the DC style. So what do you think, Abel?
So once again, what does Jordan Peters do? Because I got distracted by the Jordan Peterson thing.
what do you guys think of Jordan Peters' approach to training to failure on all sets? I believe he follows pretty similar, like DC, like all out style training.
Yeah. Well, So he is one of, from what I've seen, he's one of these like lower volume, like super balls out kind of trainees or and trainers. I think I like to train pretty intensely and with moderate volumes. And I'm not sure. So I think that he might be doing the failure thing like a bit more literally than most people do it. So yeah, he's actually failing reps. I'm inclined to say that that is probably not the best allocation of recovery resources. So I like to get all the reps that I can get, like a full rep. It doesn't necessarily have to be like a perfectly clean rep. So I'm okay with a little bit of body English or something to get that final rep if it's not like directly taking away from the stimulus, or you know, like if it's like, you know, a really like peak contraction dominant exercise, like a cable row or some kind of a curl, then a bit of body English is fine. But I don't like to miss reps, because by that point I will have pushed myself like really, really far into that high fatigue state. And that does tank my performance a lot. And also like mentally, it takes a lot out of me. And of course, like the more taxing the exercise is, the more that is the case. And it's just really like disproportionately tends to tank people's work capacity. There are some exceptions, like Jeffrey, very Schofield, could probably do that like in every set, and he would still get like very similar number of reps for like six sets straight or something. Mm-hmm. But that's rare. So I think that's not the best, you know, like management of your recovery resources. But I do like that type of training a lot more than the much more submaximal and a lot more sets. And I think you and I have talked about this, that this whole like, are you ready to train hard? But no. I mean, truly hard. You're gonna die. You're gonna die under the bar and reborn. Like, I think that is a bit of a gimmick.
Yeah.
And is just as much of a fad as the high volume stuff beyond a certain point, I think.
Yeah. There's definitely a lot of this, I don't know, belief in the pro, I don't know, like the pro realms, where they will act as if they have this unique ability to tap into, you know, I remember Jerry Ward talking about Jay Collar, like he could just, you know, he could put in so much effort into one set, and this is not possible for the average human to do. And it's like, well, I'm sure he pushes himself very hard. I don't think he has some unique ability to push harder than every other person. Like, as if that's the reason, right? I personally am a fan, probably more than a lot of the evidence-based community. I am a fan of training to failure. I do think there are numerous reasons to do it. I mean, one, just so you can actually determine where that failure point is. Two, because I think it kind of prevents you from sandbagging. Three, because I think that even now, I think there was a recent paper put out on how maybe training to failure is beneficial, although I know there was also Menno putting up that controversial one. You know, I do think that most people who, even just anecdotally, who get very far are training very hard for the most part. Again, there's exceptions, but I just don't think that many people who are just going 3 RAR are really, you know, the people who we tend to see as making long-term progress. Even the people who advocate occasional peers like that, like RP and Revive Stronger, they still have plenty of peers where they are pushing extremely hard and pushing closer to failure. So I'm a fan of it, but I've not really watched Jordan Peters train, but my understanding is he pushes things extremely hard. And I think probably for most people, if you're doing that all the time on like the big lifts and everything, that could be problematic. I like to keep it to generally one set of all out failure per exercise. And sometimes that's the first exercise, or sorry, excuse me. Sometimes that is a first set, and then I'll do some back off sets. So I might do all out, maybe trying to hit a PR first set, and then the next two sets I'll back off, and they're going to be maybe a 2 RAR, right? So that was something I did with my pull-ups for a while. So I would hit maybe like 100 for six, and then I'd back off and I'd just go to 45 pounds and I would just do stricter form, clean, two sets of eight, probably could have gotten 10 to 12 on either of those sets. And they're considerably backed off, but kind of adding volume there, technique work. Or sometimes it'll be the opposite, where I'll do three sets of an exercise, and the first one is maybe a 2 RIR, and then it's a 1 IR, and then it's like a true 0 RIR. But in both of these examples, there's still only one set that's completely all out. The other ones are still hard, but they're not, you know, it's like if you had a gun to my head, okay, I could maybe get another couple of reps.
Yeah. And by the way, like Jordan Peters, I just, as you were speaking, like I kind of replayed a couple of snippets in my head that I've seen of him on Instagram. And he is the classic example of someone who, if he was to get some really horrendous injury or like kind of like Dorian Yates style, like gradually tearing up more and more things, yeah, then people would be pointing at the failure stuff. But like the thing is that like the guy is, I mean, I don't know, 5'7" and like 300 pounds, or mm-hmm. like he actually looks like the Incredible Hulk.
Yeah.
And he is insanely strong. So like even if he had like a 4 reps in reserve kind of setup, it would still be probably, if he was going to get injured, he would be getting injured with 4 reps in reserve as well. So yeah, like it's just a good illustration of how, yeah, when you're that freaking huge and strong, then you're going to be moving some insane weights, and it on an absolute scale is going to be very, very intense pretty much no matter what you do.
Yeah, for sure. All right, next question by Zach. Super random question, or super semi-random question for you. I just watched your podcast with Menno Henselmans. My little brother, who's 23, just hopped on 200 milligrams of TRT a week, and I think he's full of crap and didn't need it. Do you have any sources on what I should read up on to tell if he's full of it? Love the podcast. Yeah, so...
Just imagine the doctor saying like, all right, sir, I think we're going to hop on 200 megs of test.
So almost certainly your brother does not need 200 milligrams of TRT per week. I would say almost nobody needs 200 milligrams of TRT per week. Of the people who need TRT, which is probably, I mean, if you break it down just statistically, how many 23-year-olds need TRT period? Maybe 1 in 100. I mean, obviously just kind of randomly throwing that out there, not many, right, who legitimately need TRT, and not, oh, I'm not at, you know, 1,000 milligrams or 1,000 nanograms per deciliter, but just you have normal testosterone, most would be in the normal range, right? And let's say it's 1%. Then how many of those would need to take 200 milligrams per week? Again, effectively none, right? 200 milligrams per week is going to have almost every male out of the normal range, out of the normal reference range for, and even more so for free testosterone, because TRT seems to bring people's free testosterone up more than total, relatively speaking. And this is actually a way I talk with Dr. Thomas O'Connor and other doctors on this. A lot of times you will see, you'll just know right away guys on TRT because their free testosterone is disproportionately high. So your brother's free testosterone is probably double the top of the normal range, or 50% over the top of the normal range on 200 milligrams per week. So he clearly almost certainly does not need it. But then it's like, does he even need TRT? You know, we could make an entire video on how to determine if somebody needs TRT. You know, you have to look at symptoms. You know, if they're not symptomatic, you know, very few people would need it. You know, what is the actual blood levels? Did he get blood work done? Did the doctor have him get blood work done? Did he have him repeat the blood work done while doing it in the morning, right? Or did he just get like a 10 p.m., you know, after dieting for 12 weeks test? So, I mean, again, I could go into a lot of detail, but any additional thoughts there, Abel?
So, I mean, it's just, I'm really curious, like, what was going on in the guy's head. Honestly, that's just the main thing that I'm always thinking about. I don't want to be beating the dead horse, because like now it's enough people are talking about how people don't need to be hopping on TRT. And it's A, because as you said, how many young, like especially at 23, I mean, you said 1 out of 100. I would guess it's more like 1 out of 1,000.
Yeah, I mean,
it's if that. But one thing that I wanted to ask back on though is you said that like it's gonna put most people out of the normal range. So like 200, where would you expect that to put like the average person? Because I heard some values which was something like four times the, so like 200 would equal like a four, I mean, an 800 nanograms per deciliter reading for the average person. But I don't know where I heard that now, but.
Yeah, no, definitely not. So, and this is, man, there's so much misinformation on this topic. It's honestly just frustrating to even hear sometimes. And, you know, I don't want to try to promote myself as some endocrinologist or anything, but I just have seen so much out there that is very clearly flawed. And by people who are reputable or at least seemingly reputable, you know, I don't want to put specific names, but people who have significant followings, and I just don't understand it because there's data on it. You know, it's not like we have to guess. So if you look at the data on people who take 500 milligrams per week, they can be as high as 3,500 nanograms per deciliter. Jesus. And they can be, but again, it depends. So when are you testing it? So one of the problems with some of these studies is that they will take the dose, and something like testosterone cypionate has a 7 to 8 day half-life. So they're taking the blood work done at the end of the week. So by that point, obviously the levels are lower. So what's the area of the curve look like? What was the peak level? You know, then nowadays, thankfully, a lot of people are recommending more frequent dosing. So maybe they break that up, right? So some people are dosing every single day, right? Some people are dosing every other day. I do think something like at least twice a week is probably a better recommendation than just once a week. But you have to look at what is that blood level going to be throughout the week. So if you were to look at some of the studies, I think in the one that 500 milligrams towards the end of the week, it might have been closer to 2,000 nanograms per deciliter in that one. But again, if you were to take it right afterwards, it would be spiked. There's a doctor who is kind of in the space. You'll see his name around here and there, who I've mentioned before, has said that he doesn't think any male should be taking less than 200 milligrams per week, which again is just absolutely insane. And he wants people to be above the reference range at the end of the week, meaning he has them at higher than the reference range all week. But no, the whole four times aspect you mentioned definitely is not accurate. Most men, to truly be at an average level, like just 600 to 800 nanograms per deciliter, would be fine on probably about 100 to 125 milligrams per week. That would be like a general rule of thumb.
So then like right after, or like the next day, like after administration, they would be then probably higher still. So
potentially, yeah. And then lower. And again, that's why I like to break it up. So I would say, like, if you took the average man and you broke that up into two times per week, like 50 to 62 and a half milligrams Sunday and 50 to 62 and a half milligrams Wednesday, then they'd probably be averaging about 600 to 800 nanograms per deciliter in the morning. But again, I don't, you know, some people could easily put on here and say, well, I take this and my levels are this. There's absolutely going to be significant variation between people here. But generally speaking, when somebody tells me 200, 250, I mean, that's really like sports TRT, quote unquote, or TRT plus, as some people say. People who are on legitimate TRT sometimes are taking, I mean, one client I had in Australia was taking 1,000 milligrams every 3 months because he was on undecanoate. So that's like a very long acting one. And again, if you just look at like the average of that over that time period, it's more in line with what I'm saying. You know, legitimate TRT, just to be middle. And again, I understand some people's points. Like Menno said, if he goes on TRT, he would want to be at the top end of the range. And I do understand that. But if you're truly just like, you know, a guy who's just 45 years old, you don't really care about the gym that much, you just actually need testosterone replacement therapy, 80 to 100 milligrams can be life-changing for somebody who's actually hypogonadal. You know what I mean? And that'll just put you in normal levels. This is one of my frustrations when I hear people say, you know, oh, well, look at this guy. He's like really jacked. He's got to be on at least TRT. Because by saying he's got to be on at least TRT, you're suggesting that TRT would be making a substantial difference above being natural. And the reality is, while it is different, and I've made the point in my podcast and a video with Menno that especially when being contest lean, it does make a big difference. The reality is, if you're just talking about like a 15% body fat male, somebody who was, let's say, naturally at 500 nanograms per deciliter, if that person then took legitimate 80 to 100 milligrams TRT per week, they should not see much of a difference. They might gain a couple pounds of muscle, lose a couple pounds of fat, but to average people, they'll look exactly the same. And this idea that like you know, just TRT is going to make some gigantic difference is only propagated by the fact that people in the industry are often lying about how much they're taking and saying it's TRT.
Yeah, although like it is kind of crazy. We talked about this, I think, even on a podcast, that like people who have blasted before, like, okay, you would say like, okay, they're maintaining a bit more because of TRT, so they will lose some. But like in Børge Fagerli's case, for example, like he discussed this pretty openly, so I can say it, like he has done cycles in the past and he has maintained a very, very impressive physique, like, I don't know, 100 kilos, so 220 pounds, lean, at like 6'1" or so. And he was on 100 milligrams per week. Mm-hmm. And then he went off of that eventually. And he lost like, I don't know, like 10 kilos or so of lean mass. Like that's pretty crazy that it can make that big of a difference.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I do want to clarify, there does seem to be some, I'm talking about somebody who's never done any cycles before, who then goes on, there's no chance that if he, let's say he's 200 pounds, right? And Børge in this case, there's no chance if he was 200 pounds and he went on 100 milligrams of TRT a week that he's going to go up to 220 pounds at the same leanness. Yeah. No way. And I've had two people on my podcast who, one openly enhanced, the other one, I believe, was enhanced, you know, less open about it, who said that TRT makes like a 20-pound difference in their case. Again, if you have cycled up and held very high body weights and musculature and then go on TRT, even 100 to 125 milligrams per week, massive difference compared to coming off. You know, John Meadows talked about this, Scott Stevenson, Dante Trudell. Assuming they're honest, and I believe these guys are honest, they have talked about holding far more. Ken Skip Hill, another one, talked about holding far more mass after blasting for years by just staying on TRT. If they come off fully, I think because they're basically going hypogonadal, right? I mean, even if they eventually recover, you're having this huge hypogonadal period after being on for so many years.
Yeah.
That is very different, though.
Yeah, and so obviously you can only speculate about this, but like just the John Meadows thing reminded me, because I think he was on 200. That's 200, what I always remember.
Had the heart attack, then went down to 100.
Uh-huh, okay. So, I mean, you know, poor guy was not on 100 for long enough so that we could know this, but like between 200, so if someone done cycles in the past, let's say he's 220, what do you think the difference would be between 200 and 100? Like, would it be, if the difference between like hypogonadal versus TRT would be 20 pounds potentially, then between 200 and 100, would it be what, 10 pounds, or what would you guess?
So obviously this is pure speculation and it's going to depend on so much else. In that particular example, if I imagine somebody was able to maintain 220 on 200 milligrams and dropped all the way down to 200 by coming off everything, I would guess they would still maintain like 215 on 100, because there's such a big difference by that huge drop, right? That huge crash is such a big problem for a lot of these guys because they've been suppressed for a decade. And like, there's just such a massive difference there. And again, you know, TRT does maintain your levels at that constant, you know, it does fluctuate throughout the week, but it's not going to have that daily rhythm where you're going to have the crashes every day. So, although even that is a little bit exaggerated, you know, if you were to look at somebody's levels at night and in the morning, it's not like somebody's going to be at 1,000 in the morning and they're going to be at 200 at night. You know, I mean, I tested my own in the morning and night, and it was like 600 versus 400, you know, I mean, at least for me personally. So it wasn't like some gigantic difference.
Right.
Yeah. Did Børge eventually go back on TRT after he had the big drop?
No. It was a long process for him, but he, like, that was his goal, that he wanted to restore himself to completely drug free. And,
did he maintain anything after all that?
So at first he lost a lot. I actually have not asked, because that was a while ago that we talked about this.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm gonna ask where he managed to climb back to.
I'd be interested to know, because that's tough, man. That's honestly one of the biggest reasons that I would not want to blast, is because I just think of it as I mean, it's already psychologically hard enough to get older and to realize that at some point you're not going to lift the same weights and you're not going to look the same and all these things. But to get to such an epic peak and then be 20 to 30 pounds less muscular after that, it's just, I can understand why a lot of people come off gear and then they just stop lifting, right? Because it's just, it got to be so depressing.
Well, I mean, if you don't go on TRT, a lot of people stay on that. That would be obvious in your case that like you would come off completely.
If I was gonna blast for 5 years, I think I would just stay on TRT afterwards. Presumably, right. I mean, I'd have to see obviously how the body responds and everything. It's very theoretical, but I don't know. And then I know a few people. I have like friends who are like, oh, I can't wait till like, you know, done having kids at 40 and then I can blast. And I was like, well, that's kind of like the worst time to do it, right? You have all the health issues and. By that point, like, do you still care about being as muscular as possible? I mean, I imagine these guys, once they get to 40, are not going to care. But it's something I
probably
know. I see, people who were like in their 20s, like, yeah, once I get to this age, I'm just going to blast. It's like, oh, I guess maybe.
Yeah, it's like the kid, like, I cannot wait until I have my own money and then I'm going to buy all this candy in the store whatever.
I was definitely that kid, man. I remember like chicken wings or like Chinese food as like a fat 8 to 10 year old, just thinking one day I would just do this, and then I got my license and I could drive anywhere. And I was like, oh, I don't actually care.
Yeah. Pretty much the same.
Yeah. This one's definitely more for you. Thoughts on the content and theories of Paul Carter and Beardsley's podcast. I've never seen them. So any thoughts from you, Abel?
Paul Carter and Beardsley have a podcast?
Maybe they're two individual podcasts. So this is Chris Beardsley. I know the name. Right. I've not seen either of their content, unfortunately, so I can't answer.
Okay. I will definitely look into this. Or maybe they just did one podcast together. Who knows? So Paul Carter. Actually, let's start with Chris Beardsley. He is a very smart guy, but he's just like, from what I've seen, he has just been less actively talking about these topics that we followed him for, or maybe he was even on the Iron Culture podcast. Like there I recall him saying something that about like not really like doing much with bodybuilding and like hypertrophy research anymore. So, but I don't know. It would be cool if he did, because I did enjoy reading his stuff. Paul Carter, I will say that I do like his exercise demonstration videos. I actually saw some cool ideas from him, even some cool little hacks, like how to set up the bench and the distance from the bench when you're doing a Bulgarian split squat. I thought that was really cool, for example. And yeah, like the guy definitely has some valuable stuff to share. He is a bit of a lunatic, and so like, I don't know, he's just like one of these constantly pissed off people, like you know, the kind of person that you would rather just leave alone that day, because okay, like you're sleep deprived and you're, you know, like the Snickers commercial, like, hey, right. You're not yourself when you're hungry. And plus, like, you know, these people who you get the feeling that they don't even really understand what they're saying, but they're just regurgitating some like really fancy words that they heard from somewhere. It's like this hydrogen ion thing is his favorite. Like he just cannot stop repeating that. So like, yeah, I'm convinced that a lot of this has to do with hydrogen ion fatigue. And I'm like, what? Like hydrogen ion fatigue? Like, so they get tired? Like, yeah, so it's... more or less it. Like it's kind of like the what do you have in the US, Costco? That would be like what Tesco is over here. So he would be the Tesco or Costco version of Kasim Hansen. That's right. As far as I'm concerned.
That's funny. I know so many people I hear talk about them. I haven't checked out their content. So do facial muscles actually hypertrophy after years of lifting due to strain when pushing hard? I would say yes, although you ever see mewing? You ever see people talk about mewing?
That was just what I was going to ask. I just thought about this randomly the other day.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, any muscle you work is going to hypertrophy. I have patients who I will give Botox to in their master muscles and sometimes their temporalis muscle for a number of reasons that they're clenching. There's some women who you could probably even just Google it, you'll see, where they actually look like they got leaner because their masters are so big. It gives them these kind of like full cheeks. And then over time, those are kind of slimmed down. People get headaches from a lot of clenching. Sometimes we'll do Botox for that as well. But yeah, so if you're working it, I don't know necessarily just from lifting, but hopefully you're not clenching a ton while you're lifting. I mean, obviously you're going to strain, but hopefully you're not actually just like clenching down on your jaw like crazy. I know some people will wear actually like a bite guard while they lift. But yeah, I think generally if you look at somebody who's gained 50 pounds of muscle overall, I mean, their neck, their jaw, everything is going to kind of change muscularly.
Yeah, actually. So what is mewing?
Mewing is this, there's like a device and like they'll actually just kind of be like chewing on it, and they'll argue there's these different benefits for it. Some people do it just for the jaw aesthetics of it. It's not something that I'm like super well versed in. I've just kind of seen it around.
Uh-huh. And so I was going to ask, like, so you as someone who does these aesthetic surgeries and, you know, people who work in that field as well, what's going on? So this is something I have a very hard time just wrapping my head around, that I'm seeing some of these millionaire superstars from Hollywood and some of these surgeries that they have. Like, I watched the Friends reunion show.
Yeah.
And like Jennifer Aniston and all of these people who look like really good in Friends. And it's like, what happened to you? It looks horrible. And how can that happen? Like, what's going on with these?
A lot of times that's just too much filler. You know, I did see the Friends reunion, or I saw a scene or two from the Friends reunion. And I mean, part of it's just age, right? So sometimes you'll see these people who they'll do these videos of like then and now, and like, you know, and it's actually very consistent in the comment section. You'll get people who say, oh my God, they were so much prettier before they got all this plastic surgery. And it's like, yeah, because you're looking at a picture of them when they were 20 years old, and now you're looking at a picture of them when they're 40 years old. You're like, oh my God, look what they ruined their face. It's like they aged 20 years. Like, they're not going to look exactly the same. So that is, I know that's not what you're saying, but I'm just, a lot of times I do want to point that out, because a lot of the time you'll see that and it's like, of course they're not going to look as good at 40 compared to 20, you know, with some of these women in Hollywood. Secondly, I do think I'm not a big fan of filler to the extent that it's often used. I think Botox can actually be great from a quote unquote anti-aging, again, just aesthetically standpoint, because essentially you're just removing the ability to create wrinkles, right? So how Botox works is it's actually kind of knocking out the ability of the muscle to contract. That's why we'll do it in the masseters and temporalis, so people actually cannot strain to the same extent. But when people get it in their forehead or, you know, at the crow's feet and whatnot, they will essentially not get the wrinkles there because they can't use the function. I, you know, sometimes you'll see like botched Botox and whatnot, and somebody's like eyebrows up here, or, you know, whatever. But the reality is Botox is relatively safe. Botox doesn't tend to even be noticed when done correctly. Whereas filler, there's more potential risk, especially like if it were to get into a vessel with filler. But also that's when you tend to see a lot of these women in their 40s and 50s and whatnot, where like their cheeks are just because they do the filler here with the idea being to kind of lift. So their face is starting to sag. So they'll do filler to kind of try to push things up. Problem is, it's actually been shown in some MRIs now recently that filler, they'll tell you it lasts 6 to 12 months. It seems like it actually sticks around for a much longer period of time. And so there's some MRIs showing that people had filler there 10 years later, but it had just kind of drifted. So you get somebody who's had years and years and years of filler, and their faces are puffy, and maybe it looks good in this one straight shot. So they'll be like, oh, wow, that looks great. But then they'll turn and it's just like, oh, you can just kind of see that look. And I honestly, again, I don't want to ignore the thing I just said about Botox, how you often just think of the worst case scenario. I understand that happens with filler too. We'll see the worst case scenario. But to me, it's just much more common that it's a problem. You know, if you have so many people with millions and millions of dollars who still can't seem to get it right and still look so ridiculous, you got to think at that point, maybe it's a problem with the procedure and not just like you went to a bad person. You know, I've seen filler look really good if done in modest amounts in the lips, in the under eyes and things like that. But once you start trying to get into like lifting the cheeks and all these things, or like, I don't know if that's what Zac Efron had, but he had something going on there with like this big puffy face. That is when I think it becomes problematic. And so I did see in that reunion, whoever plays Monica, that actress, she had like way too much stuff done.
And Ross.
Ross looked, was, yeah. Now he actually, I think he just also gained a lot of weight. I think his was a combination of
probably
gain and filler. So of course, when you get the combination, you get these super puffy faces. And then people talk about, oh, well, you can dissolve it. But the problem is like you dissolve it with something called hyaluronidase, but that some people will say there's nothing to show that it will dissolve the natural hyaluronic acid. Because so that's what it, for people, let me back up a second. People who don't know, a lot of the fillers are hyaluronic acid, like a gel. And so you can dissolve that with hyaluronidase, but the problem is your body naturally has hyaluronic acid in it. And so theoretically you could dissolve your natural hyaluronic acid. And that's kind of disputed. Some people say that that's never been shown to do that and there's no problems with it. But I've certainly anecdotally heard of people who kind of get some indentations afterwards. So it just gets into like a kind of tricky realm. And I'm not a big fan of like the big lip filler lips that you see some of these people, like all the girls on Jersey Shore have. I just think it's such an odd look. So yeah, I don't know. It's a little ramble there, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I definitely planning to have the most horribly like baggy, like wrinkly eyes. Mm-hmm. Like if I just am slightly sleep deprived, which does happen pretty like frequently enough to where usually it looks like that, and it's it's going to be, but like now I'm scared, like what would happen if I was to do that, like would someone completely mess me up? But
yeah, you gotta, I would think it's qualified for sure. The bags though, there's two different things though, because it might be not that you would need not that you would need filler, but you would need a blepharoplasty would be for like the big baggy under eyes. So that's a different procedure. Mm.
Uh-huh. All right. We'll see.
Yeah. let's see. So do rep drop-offs between sets tell us anything about how to adjust our training? That's a good one.
Yeah, that's a good one. I think it does to some extent. I think that if someone has, so like there is like kind of a standard range, I think, where most people are going to fall into, and that's going to be something like 2 reps or so for like a relatively intense set. So like maybe if you were, so it's not like the biggest grinder from hell that you're doing, but it is pretty hard and you definitely wouldn't have another rep. After that, most people are going to drop something like 1 or 2 reps, something like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if someone is dropping like, I don't know, 4 or more, I mean, probably like you could talk about percentages more so, but like, you know, if someone goes from 8 reps to 4, that would be an above average drop off. If someone can maintain their performance, even though it was like a really hard grinder and not after half an hour of rest, but you know, like 3 to 5 minutes even, that would be like definitely above average, like performance maintenance. And so I think that can inform someone's kind of general volume tolerance, or can inform us about that. So people who like Børge Fagerli, for example, like he responds, like Jeff Albers, for example, responds very well to lower volumes. And so he would be one of those people, and I don't think it's just a coincidence, who drops off a lot of reps when he trains. I would say I myself am fairly average, and my rep drop-offs are actually very average. I'm not exactly sure what Jeffrey's are, but I would not be surprised that with his very high volume tolerance, he would not be losing a lot of reps from set to set. So yeah, that's what I tend to think. So yeah, like maybe be more willing to experiment with higher volumes if your reps really don't tend to drop off, even though you're training hard. That would be my answer.
Yeah. I don't think that if somebody were to tell me just the numbers that it would be that informative. Like they just said, hey, like I did a set of 12 and then I did a set of 7 or something. You know, I would, because there's so many factors that could cause a rep drop off. So, but I do think it's a good question because it could tell you how to adjust your training with more questioning. So first I would say, well, how long are you resting? Right. Obviously that's huge. So I'll do rest pause training and I'll do 16 reps and then I'll drop to 7 reps and then I'll get 5 reps because I'm only resting 40 seconds in between. Right. So that's obviously a huge factor. Do you need to just rest longer? The other aspect I would say, of course, that you mentioned is proximity to failure. So if I do a set of 10 and it's a 3 RAR, I could get another set of 10 and maybe it's a 1 RAR. Yeah. And then maybe I get a final set and it's like 9-10, but it was a true all out, like I'm going to die kind of a set. So do you need to go closer to failure if all of you, you know, if you're able to do 5 sets of 10 with the same weight and 2 minutes of rest time between each set? Then you're what that tells me is you need to get closer to failure because your first 2 sets might be 5 RAR in that case, right? And then thirdly, I do think what Abel pointed out about your tolerance for volume. So let's assume normal rest times of 2 to 4 minutes. Let's assume normal proximity to failure of, you know, 1 to 2 RAR, then, or even 0 a bit. Let's call it 1 because I mean 0, I think it's like a true 0 RAR, you are going to have a pretty big drop off most of the time. In that case, then sure, that could probably tell you about your volume tolerance. I've mentioned my buddy Kevin a few times on the podcast. I remember in college he would get 12 and then he'd get like 11 and then he'd get 11. I was like, how are you doing this? Like I would be doing 12, 7, 5, and if you look at our training historically, I kind of like lower volume training. Historically, he will tend to do 1 or 2 body parts on a day, do 16 to 20 plus sets, right? And I don't think that's necessarily a coincidence. And again, Jeffrey Berry Schofield is a good example. So if you're keeping all those variables fairly normal, we'll call it, I do think maybe that tells you that you do want to maybe potentially at least experiment with higher volumes and see how well you tolerate them.
I agree.
Cool. This one is definitely more of like a hypothetical. So, and I realize that I haven't been saying everybody's names on here, but hopefully they recognize their own question. And this one, I'm not even going to pronounce, Matik Poliknik. This is an interesting one. Would a drug that removes all mental exercise fatigue change the way we train cardio too? So like an NZT for mental exercise fatigue. Does that question make sense?
I think so. Yeah. That's a good question, actually. Of course, my mind immediately went to diet. Like, I think the effect would be more pronounced there. But like, yeah, that's a good question, right? Because like, there is definitely a thing where you, like, if you do Bulgarian split squats, like, yeah, sure, it does fatigue your quads a lot and like cardiovascularly as well. There is just the act of hating something so bad that can be draining. And then like with these very demanding exercises, like the cardio fatigue and the local muscular fatigue, that's one thing, but also just the process of like knowing that it's going to be brutal, willing yourself to go there, overcoming that inertia. And then going there, like wanting to quit midway through the set, but not quitting, finishing, and then your lungs are burning, like that initial couple of seconds can be just really bad. And you're like, oh my God, like, I wish I could just spit my lungs out here because this hurts so bad.
Yeah.
And then knowing that, okay, like 3 minutes is almost up, so I need to go back there and do this again. So like, when you go through like 3-4 sets like that, which a lot of people do, like it might seem like, well, if you're hating it that much, then just don't do it. But a lot of people, I mean, that's their training life, essentially. Like you look at Dorian Yates training legs. I'm pretty sure it was something like this. If you could just eliminate all of that and just basically forget that this set ever happened, I'm pretty sure that you could actually tolerate more. So yeah, but it's an interesting thought experiment for sure.
Yeah, I think there's two ways to read the question. So would it change the way we prescribe and recommend training? maybe a little bit. Like if you think of what do we recommend as ideal training, maybe it would change it a little bit because inevitably there's going to be a practicality to what we recommend and things like that. I think if the question is, would it change how we actually train, then of course, I think hugely, right? I mean, you think of the average person, how many they just will not do, you know, multiple sets of heavy squats and deadlifts or leg press, especially like leg days and back days. Most people are going to shy away from the hardest exercises. Most people are going to shy away from true failure because it's difficult because there's that fatigue within the set. There's the fatigue between the sets. I mean, even hardcore advocates like DC trainees will oftentimes put some of the hardest stuff towards the end of the workout. They actually do their squats and deadlifts at the end because they know that after you do those, you're going to be so fried that you're not going to want to do the rest of your workout. So even people as intense as that are factoring that into their training. So if you just had some pill where it was basically making it so that you don't have that fatigue in between, even if it's just mentally, that you're just ready to go again. Of course, we'd all, I'm sure, train very different. And then even more so, I'd say, for cardio was the last part of that question. I mean, I've mentioned several times on this podcast, I think I'm more impressed by extreme cardio athletes than I am extreme weightlifting athletes because the amount of just pure suck that you have to go through for some of these things. I mean, 2-hour marathons and, you know, like 50-mile races. I mean, that's just unbelievable. And the mental fortitude that takes is truly admirable.
Yeah. And then like dieting, I mean, you know, it's such a huge component. Just, the fact that you have been doing something for months and that, you know, like denying yourself your instinctive kind of desires and like, how many things you said no to, how many times you battled with yourself and whatever. I mean, you know, the better you get at this, like the less of that you need to do because you have like, not smart structures set up, but still you just miss that, you know, freedom element of eating and socializing and whatever. So yeah, like if you could eliminate all of that, I mean, holy shit, like how much easier it would be to get into the shape that you want.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much to be said for that chronic fatigue. I mean, we've talked before about how somebody who's never done an extended period of time dieting, 3+ months, just can't really relate to the hunger. Like, I don't care how hungry you get on one day. It's just not relatable to somebody who's been hungry for months and months on end. But there's the physical aspect there, right? Which is just the actual hunger in that moment is a different type of hunger. But a huge portion of it is also just mentally that fatigue. I mean, if you were to snap your fingers right now and just your brain is now in the body of your super diet itself, it would suck, but you'd be, I imagine that you would probably be like, well, I am quite hungry, but I mean, I remember being just full the last like 3-4 months. It's just not the same as like day after day after day after day. Same thing with chronic pain. You know, most people who are in chronic pain, there are people who kill themselves over chronic pain. It's very rare that chronic pain is a 9 out of 10. It's that it's a 4 or 5 out of 10 every single day, relentlessly with no end, right? That's that real long-term exposure.
No, it's with the hunger and of course, like there are lots of things again that make it difficult to separate the physical from the mental because, you know, okay, like you might be very hungry physically, but then if I threw you out of a plane or something, eventually your parachute would open up, but like for the first like 5 seconds, it wouldn't. I'm guessing that you would not be hungry. while falling, and even when you landed, like you would completely forget about the fact that you were hungry not that long ago because your catecholamine levels would be like through the roof. And that's a physical effect, but obviously changes your mental state. And like, you know, let's like take a person who obviously is not falling from anywhere but is just sitting in front of their computer, but they're like just they forgot get to eat and they get by on very low calories and they get like accidentally super skinny. And, you know, is that person just mentally wired that way, or is that also a physical effect? Like maybe they're so engaged with what they're doing that their catecholamine levels rise, maybe not as much but like quite a bit more than the average person would have it. And that's a physical effect at that point, right? So it's hard to tell. but it's interesting.
Okay, so Ahmad says, how low of protein intake can I get away with? My best days are at 1.2 grams per kilogram. It's expensive where I live.
Yeah, so I think it's one thing to remember. First of all, in these cases, I do like to, as just in case, which I can't now, but I would if this person was talking to me directly, like, is this any kind of protein? Because some people only count protein sources or protein from like the highest quality sources, so like animal sources typically. But, you know, it's not the highest quality protein, but if you're eating, I don't know, like lettuce and potatoes and even fruits, like there's some protein in that. So are you counting that as well? And that's how you're getting to this 1.2 figure. But one thing that's good to remember is that, you know, it's not a cutoff point. So it's not like 1.6 grams per kilo or 1.8 grams per kilo, 0.8 grams per pound. It's not like that is the point where you start building muscle and retaining muscle. It's all on a spectrum. And, you know, 1.2 grams per kilo is fairly close to what we believe to be the optimal figure. And like, actually, the number above which, I mean, really, it seems like no study has found any benefits, to my knowledge, is actually 1.6. The figure that we are more commonly recommending, that 1.8 grams or 0.8 grams per pound, that is, there is more of a, like, there is a safety margin that's added on top of the figures that we actually found. So, you know, at 1.2, you're actually fairly close. So if you're 100 kilos, that's 120 grams versus 160. Like, if you think about it, like, compare, like, zero would be the lowest number that you could consume. I mean, you're quite some ways there towards the optimal. So those 40 grams, how much of a difference will that make? If it makes any difference, probably not that much. And probably still there's some difference between maintenance versus gaining. And then there's some difference between gaining or gaining the absolute theoretical maximal amount. So, and as with most things, usually the difference between those two is not that big. Like, just like with muscle growth, like, you know, gaining any muscle versus gaining the maximal amount of muscle, for a beginner, that will be quite a lot. For, you know, someone who has been training for even like 5 years, it's not even going to be detectable potentially. So, yeah, but it's hard to tell, like, how much you can get away with. Like, get away with in what sense? To still gain muscle or to retain muscle? That would be just conjecture. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a fair question to ask. It's funny, I haven't released a podcast at the time of this recording, but Brian Borsi and I just did a podcast. We were just talking about how it's funny for us to hear about some people saying they can't get their protein intake in. A lot of times it's women. We were talking about Rhonda Patrick, who said it's so hard for her to get, I think, even like not even close to 1 gram per pound. And, you know, she's 130 pounds. And I just think, I can't imagine that being hard, but I think that's just because we've been in this space for so long. We're so used to the 1 gram per pound. I mean, even Peter Attia, to my surprise, was saying that a lot of people are going to find that difficult. And I guess it's just because the average person isn't used to that. Whereas since I was 13 years old, I was just pounding protein. Actually, when I was in college and following a lot of the DC stuff, I was having 2 grams per pound of protein, which was totally ridiculous. I was eating 300 plus grams of protein at 160 pounds, which was, again, just silly. And I then went down to 1 gram per pound and I saw no detriment at all. And if anything, obviously the food tasted much better because, I mean, you're trying to get 2 grams per pound on a 2,500 calorie, you know, if it was not a surplus day, is ridiculous. So the food was a lot better, less expensive. And again, just no difference in results whatsoever. And I've almost never seen somebody who really said, wow, I just saw so much better results at something like 2 grams per pound. Again, unless they're like these enhanced DC guys, and even half of them will say later, like, oh, once I dropped it, it didn't really matter. So I'm glad to see that that's pretty much been walked back and very few people would recommend it. And just to one more further point there, sometimes I'd say, oh, it really helped me break back up or break through a plateau when I added 100 grams of protein. It's like, well, yeah, because you just added 400 plus calories, depending on the source, you know, maybe even twice that depending on the source. So in any case, I think 1 gram per pound is a good standard, but then of course that also has to factor in your body fat, right? I mean, I have a client right now who's like 35% body fat. That person does not need 1 gram per pound of body weight, right? That it might be a little bit better to go 1 gram per pound of lean body mass, which is probably a better gauge anyway. It's just most of us, if you're in that, you know, 10 to 15% body fat range, it's not going to be such a big difference. And I'd rather you be a little bit, you know, err on the side of caution there. But I think what you said, how much of a difference is it really making? It's funny because when it comes to training and some of these other things, we do often talk about how you get the vast majority of the results from, you know, maybe like the 3 days per week or whatever it is that you're doing, however much volume. And yet we don't really talk about that as much with protein. It's just kind of said, okay, 1 gram per pound, just get that. And it's very rarely nuanced to say, well, honestly, you'll get vast majority of the benefits, even if you have 0.7 grams per pound or something along those lines, right? We don't really hear that talked about so much. And even with myself, I mean, people often comment how I've experimented with so much over the years from different training and diets and everything, but I honestly have never had an extended period ever where I've had less than 1 gram per pound of protein. I just haven't done it. And I would imagine that at this point, because it's so much easier to maintain and I don't really gain a much these days, I don't think I probably would see a difference. I think some about 200 pounds. If I had 100 grams of protein per day, I bet I would probably look almost identical, maybe a small difference there. But it's tough with the position I'm in, as I've mentioned before, just because something maintains muscle for me now doesn't mean it's what I would recommend to somebody who wants to gain as much muscle as possible. So just based on the evidence, I still say shoot for 1 gram per pound. It's hard to say how much can I get away with. Well, it's like, what do you mean by that? How much can you get away with and see results, or how much can you get away with and not like veer too far away from what's ideal? They're two very different questions. I'm sure you still see great results even on 80 grams per pound, or sorry, 80 grams per pound, something like 80 grams of protein. I'm sure you could still see great results with 0.5 grams of protein per pound, but what is going to be ideal and what I recommend to clients would probably be different than that.
And plus like other things are influencing that as well, like if you're shooting, like I think the lower you're going to get, like the more important it could be potentially to pay extra attention to these things like timing and distribution and all those things. Like, yeah, like for example, when you're eating 2 grams per pound, I would guess that it's a lot less important because like there's just so much stuff like floating around all the time.
No, that's a really good point, because that is true. You know, if you're talking about the quality of protein, Eric Trexler has some great stuff on this too. If you want to check out some of his stuff with mass and just, I think he's probably had articles on Stronger by Science about this stuff, that's great. Because if you're a vegetarian and you're eating 0.7 grams per pound of protein, then you probably are gonna have to care a little bit more when it comes to the timing of things, right? Maybe you want to get it within a closer window from when you worked out and whatnot. You just kind of have more wiggle room when you're eating 1 gram per pound. So I usually do shoot for 200, and that's one of the issues with, like, you know, I hate to knock him, but you know, Dom Mazzetti, the character, a lot of people know his like bro science videos. His name is Mike Tornabene. And he was from where I was in New Jersey, like very, very similar. But he just came out with some protein candy and it's like, oh, 20 grams of protein or whatever it is. But the protein is gelatin, right? And that's obviously not a very high quality source of protein, you know, for our purposes here. So you have to look at the quality of that stuff too, because you could just throw in like a cheap, you know, a cheap product there and people might think, oh, I'm getting so much protein, but it's like, you know, from oatmeal and gelatin and whatever. And that's not really what we're looking for.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. So we got one or two more here. So Opinions on reducing volume during a cut, as apparently it's easier to maintain muscle. You want to go with this one, Abel, because you've had a lot of successful cuts.
Yeah, so I had some cuts where I was stubborn and kept my volume up, even though I was losing strength quite fast by the end. It was definitely not a good idea. Also had some cuts where, actually the first one, like really big cut that I did when I was younger. With that one, I actually dropped my volume a bit too much because I was following Martin Burkan and some of these guys that were like, some of their routines were super, super low volume. That was not good. I actually ended up losing strength because previous to that was the first time where I actually hit some really nice strength PRs for myself at the time and couldn't maintain a lot of that. And so honestly, at this point, like it's quite simple for me. Like if your volume is remotely appropriate for you, and you're not doing something special as an experiment like I did now with the back training. So, okay, I was doing like in total like 70 sets of back work or whatever. It's not because I thought I needed 70 sets. I was just like throwing the kitchen sink at it and like seeing if that's going to make a difference. If you're doing something like that and then you go into a cut, yeah, like that's probably not going to fly because it was barely tolerable while I was eating, you know, everything in sight, and I was gaining a ton of fat and a ton of body weight, but you know, I was obviously very, very well fed to recover. If I'm going into a cut, then yeah, like it will have to be tapered down. But if I was doing something like, I don't know, like 12 sets or something, which historically always treated me well, I'm not sure if that's the exact right amount for me, but like it must be in the ballpark at least. I think that should only be tapered down reactively, because I just don't see why you would taper it down proactively. I think that your recovery status will inform you whether that's needed or not. Now, again, that is if you're using a volume amount, which is like at least somewhat well-informed. Like if you're just blasting yourself with a whole bunch of volume just for the sake of it, then yeah, probably you should be open to reducing that relatively fast if there are signs that you might not be recovering from this. So yeah, that's more or less what I think. How about you?
So for me, most people probably know that I am generally a fan of moderate volumes, sometimes even low volumes. It depends. I like to start people off with lower generally and see how they respond. And then I'll gradually kind of ramp them up from there. But you know, most of my body parts are getting between 8 to 12 sets per week. You know, some in a certain phase might get up to 16, but it's usually not super high volume. So I definitely don't just go into a cut and say, all right, I'm just going to slash volume. There may be instances where I'm pretty deep into a cut where I'm really fatigued and I'll say, okay, maybe some of the volume that I added during a bulking phase to bring something up, I will now kind of take off and just go to maintenance. But I mean, if I think of my most successful cut, which was in 2020, most body parts other than back were getting 6 sets per week total. And I maintained pretty much everything during that cut. It was a very good cut for me. But even then, like I said, when I was bulking prior to that, it was only slightly more. So it's not something that I changed too much. I'm not really big on dramatic changes in volume as a stimulus. I think changes in frequency, I think obviously changing your calories depending on your goal, different exercises can be great. But you're not going to see me recommending somebody start with 6 and ramp up to 24 sets per week. It's just not something that I really believe in.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting, like how much our thinking has, I mean, obviously like there are no revolutionary things in the world of training, at least not within a span of like whatever, 5 years. But like, I remember Lane Norton said something back in 2014, 15, which I'm sure he would never say that now, is that like I remember someone asking him this pretty much, and he's like, no, like volume should not be going down on a cut. If anything, volume should go up. Like, if you think about it, like, why would your body maintain your muscle if you're taking away the stimulus? And it's interesting, like, even someone like him could, like, still fall for that, you know, logical fallacy of more is always better.
Mm-hmm.
And like, definitely not be saying it now. I would be shocked if he did. So
Mike Isretel, I remember, so when I first came across him, it was 2017, I want to say. And so I didn't really know much about him. And somebody sent me his Facebook page. And one of the first posts I saw was him saying that, you know, people know that it was often a myth in the, I don't know, 80s and so that you and 90s that you want to increase, do higher reps to cut, right? Because that's going to give you the shreds and whatnot, right? And then it was kind of showing, okay, that's obviously BS. And he was putting up a post saying that you should go to higher reps while cutting because it'll burn a little more calories and it's better for volume. It's a good way to get increased volume. And I just remember being so shocked. I was like, what? Like, this is a guy who's supposed to be, you know, this, like, I don't know. I don't want to say guru, but this is a guy who's supposed to be this great mind in the space. And he's telling people to go to high reps when dieting. Like, how is this possible? Now, his reasoning was different, right? His reasoning was more for the sake of volume as a stimulus and not because high reps are going to lead to shreds or anything like that. But I believe he would probably walk back that statement now as well, because I just don't find that to be great advice for people. You're losing, like, if you were just to switch all of your reps to higher reps in the 20 to 30 range, for example, that is certainly not advice I would be giving anybody.
Yeah. And it's interesting, like, even relatively recently, and I don't really know what to attribute that to, because it's certainly not like, so I'll say first what that is, but Mike, like, I frequently heard things from him that basically, like, gave it away that he thinks that higher, like heavier weights and lower reps are more fatiguing than lighter loads and higher reps, which, I mean, unless someone is, like, training super far away from failure, which, okay, this is a pretty high ball to slam down to make some jokes about, but, like, Mike lifts some super, super heavy weights. So I'm really surprised that he feels this way, because, like, if he does high reps, I mean, that's going to be crazy fatiguing, I would imagine. And for me, definitely, like, even like 10 reps can be kind of overwhelming on some stuff. Whereas, like, 5 reps, like, yeah, it's very, like, it can be hard on the joints, but as far as, like, which one is more fatiguing, I mean, the higher reps definitely are more fatiguing. And I would think that for most people it is. Sure, some people have some amazing cardio. But Mike, like, repeatedly said things that kind of alluded to this. So,
well, I know a lot of people would argue that the lower rep ranges with higher weights would be more demanding from a quote unquote CNS standpoint, right? And that was kind of talked about, like, it's just, you know, because of the high loads. And then I think more recently it has been discussed that no, it's actually more the peripheral nervous system, and that actually no, the higher reps are more fatiguing. I remember. And I think once you start getting into fatigue and the nervous system, you know, you start getting into some theoretical arguments. But if we're just talking about difficulty, of course, higher reps to failure are way harder, I think, for most people. And I remember I brought this up before a long time ago, but on the T Nation forums, there was this guy, never saw any pictures of him, but his name was Encephalic Carnage. And he never really showed his pictures or anything, but it was him, Professor X, and they're both around 300 pounds. And I remember him saying, this Professor X character was a leaner version of than he was. So I'm like, okay, well, this Professor X guy is kind of fat. So that you must be like, this is this fat enhanced powerlifter, which in thinking back makes sense based on the things he was saying. And I remember saying how higher reps were just so much harder. And he goes, oh, well, if that's what you think, then you just aren't conditioned. And I'm thinking, what person would think that a 10 rep max squat, for example, is not harder than a 1 rep max squat? I just can't imagine. Like, I mean, don't get me wrong, a 1 rep max, like, they can be extremely hard. You got to mentally psych yourself up. But if you're actually considering a true 0 RAR 10 rep squat or dead, I mean, that's just absolutely horrible. So from a difficulty standpoint, yeah, no question.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, guys, so that is the end here of the whole Q&A part 2 here on Abel's channel. Abel, thank you for joining me as always. And I guess I would normally say to where can we find you? But I guess if people are listening, they're on yours already. So go over to the Brains and Gains channel. I'll pin my channel here. Check out part one over there.
Indeed, guys.
And and Abel, I mean, again, people are going to know this on your channel, but do you want to talk any more about your book, about where to find it and all that?
Oh, yeah. Thank you for that question. So if you go on ssdable.com/book, you can find it there. And in my YouTube videos, I'm going to be spamming it in the video description. But yeah, really cool book. From what I've heard, people seem to like it. And it's about how to put together awesome training programs. Basically, the description of the book is the title, in a sense.
Awesome. All right. Thanks again, man.
Thank you.